Take your book that you have there, if you have that book, and turn to page number 10. Page number 10. We'll talk about substitutions tonight. I don't know about you, but I'm, the word sugar in our house does not have good connotations. I have some daughter-in-laws who are really kind of, fanatics about this thing, about how bad sugar is for you, right? And basically, my attitude is, sugar is good, right? I mean, that's my attitude, really. So when the grandkids come over and so forth, they get things at grandpa's house, because grandma doesn't really know this. I mean, she knows it, but she doesn't really approve. But they get stuff from grandpa that they don't get at their own house. And so they like coming to my house because I like sugar. I like stuff. Now, when it comes to this whole thing about trying to lose weight and trying to eat healthy and all stuff, so years they came with all these substitutes for sugar. And so, it came out, and there was whatever these are, Equal and Sweet and Low and Splenda, and one of them causes cancer, and one of them causes something else, and one of them causes memory loss, yeah, whatever, all these things have been everything's bad for you. I just conclude everything is bad. Food is bad. I mean, everything. There's some article about some food, and it's going to be bad for you. So I've just decided to, I'm going to die anyway, so let's just go with it. Anyway, so I like sweet and low when it comes to, sweetening things. And whatever your substitute is, I'm not talking about your health here, but I'm saying the problem is when it comes to spiritual things, it's okay to substitute, I was going to say tofu for meat, but who eats tofu? Oh, no, some people do. Never mind. Okay. Anyway, it's good to do that. I mean, that's great. Some people don't eat certain things. That's fine. But when it comes to the spiritual realm, the problem is we have substituted some things in our life for the living water, and it's not really healthy for us. Now, if you turn your book there, it gives a list of things that you enjoy. Nothing wrong with enjoying things. I want you to write down there in your book there, just by some of these things, some people you enjoy. Write down a couple names there on your paper of people that you enjoy. No problem with that. We're going to stop here just a minute. My alarm just went off. We've started doing something the last few years, about 3 years ago, and that is wherever we're at 7:14, we stop what we're doing and pray for revival. Just based on 2 Chronicles 7:14. So we do this. If we're out to eat with somebody, we stop and pray. If we're at a ball game, we stop and pray. That whatever we're doing, 7:14. So I'm going to ask you to do something. Just for the next few nights, take out your phone right now. Okay, everybody, just you have permission. Take out your phone and go to the alarms. If you don't know how to do this, ask your kids when you get home, or your grandkids. But go to where it is clock and go to alarms. I want you to set your alarm for 7:14 p.m. tomorrow night. So tomorrow night at 7:14 in the service, hundreds of phones are going to go off. Okay, it'll be okay. Even if it's on silent, your phone still goes off, so it's okay. And we're going to hear it now tomorrow night, and we'll stop at 7:14 and pray for revival. Now make sure tomorrow night at 7:14 when your phone goes off, don't hit snooze. If you hit snooze, it'll go off again in 5 minutes, and then you'll be embarrassed. But it'll be okay at 7:14 because all of our phones are going to go off and we're going to stop and pray for revival. And I hope that after we finish these days, it'll become a pattern in your life. You can turn it off if you want on Thursday, but I hope you don't. I hope you do that and keep on focusing, maybe just even through the elections. That'd be worth it. And pray for revival. 7:14. Let's do that right now. Father, we understand that you've said that if we as your people would humble ourselves and pray and seek your face and turn from our wicked ways, that things are going to change. And the fact is, we are looking to Washington, D.C., and we're looking to culture, we're looking to somebody else when that circle starts with us. And so tonight, we would acknowledge to you that we are needy people. And we want in these days to turn from our idols, from our substitutes, and we want that living water. And we ask in your grace and mercy that you would heal our land. God, it's not about America. God, I pray you would heal your world. We groan with creation for your return, and believe that you're going to purify your bride. And we say we are a mess. We're broken, and we need you to do what's happened in days gone by, as Reggie's preached in the last few weeks, where you have sovereignly set down on a nation, whether it was Wales or the United States in times where we call the Great Awakenings, where you did something beyond the scope of our ability. God, we long for that. We need that. We plead for that. Please do a reviving work in your church that would impact the lost, that would change the world. And we give you praise in advance for what we believe you're going to do. In the name of Jesus, I pray. Amen. All right, that's a sidelight, but we want to live in the reality of praying for that. So anyway, okay, where was I at now? Can you remember? Oh yeah, on your cup there. Everybody have a cup? Anybody not have a cup? Okay, make sure everybody has a cup. You're going to use that here in a minute. But right now, on your paper, write down a couple of people that you enjoy. This is just not a bad thing. It's a couple of people you enjoy. Then write down in your book here, where it says substitutions, write down a couple of possessions that you enjoy. It's not a bad thing. It could be your home, a vehicle. Maybe you possess a degree that's significant to you. Clothing or investments or jewelry or your smartphone. There's a new phobia. It's called nomophobia. A lot of people have it. It's the fear of being away from their phone, right? And it's really a medically treated phobia that some people have. They got to have a cell reception. By the way, we have terrible reception here in this area. Do y'all have bad reception here? Okay, anyway, so I'm kind of living in nomophobia right now. Anyway, or maybe people just have to see their phone. Some people just have to be able to see their phone, or they kind of go a little crazy, you know? Okay, that's fine. Put that down, possession. Maybe put down a couple of places you really enjoy. Maybe you enjoy work or the university, or maybe you enjoy, you know, Florida. I put Florida down on mine. I like Florida. The older I get, the more I like warmth, and it's warm there. Put down a couple of things you enjoy entertainment-wise. Maybe put down your favorite football team, or maybe you enjoy Facebook or Pinterest, or maybe you like going to movies. Maybe there's the video games that you like, or something. Write down a couple of things just that you enjoy. This is not a trick, okay? Just write down a couple of things you enjoy. Not bad. It's good. It's fine. God's made all things for our enjoyment. And then write down a couple hobbies you enjoy. Could be hunting, fishing. I like golf, because when I go golfing, I can do three things: hunt, fish, and golf at the same time, because my ball's usually where it shouldn't be. Anyway, maybe reading. You like reading. Maybe your sport is knitting. Put that down, whatever. Maybe you like eating. Maybe your hobby's eating, and that's a great one. Okay, wait, or crafts. So just write down a few things there in your book, things you enjoy, okay? This is just a starting point. Now here's the problem. Those good things can become too important. And that's our problem. Good things, it says there in your books, good things become passions that slowly consume our hearts. So those things can become things that not only are good, but they can be things that steal our joy. So these same things, people and possessions and all the places and all the entertainment and all the hobbies, these things can take our joy away from us if they become too important, or if those are the things we're turning to find satisfaction. And they can end up controlling us. Now, I want us to talk about that a few minutes tonight. So I want to ask you a question. I want you to all answer me verbally. Okay, I'm going to ask it, and all of you verbally answer me out loud. How are you tonight? Most of you are fine. Okay, fine, great, good, whatever. I mean, that's pretty much what we say. But the fact is, most of us are not really fine at all. But we've just known that that's what we're supposed to say. Some of us, how are you? We just say fine. Now, if we're really honest, and really, sometimes you ask people how they are, and they say, well, I'm not. And they say, I'm not bad, or I'm not a drug addict, or I'm not. And we tell people, well, we aren't. That's not really honest communication. I didn't say, how aren't you? I want to know, how are you? You say, how am I? Well, I feel pretty good. I felt great when I got up this morning, but I got over it, you know, or whatever. Or I feel lousy, and we love to tell people how we feel. That's fine. It's good for a husband to say to your wife, how do you feel? That's a good thing, but that's not my question tonight. Well, some would say, I'm doing okay. I'm doing good. I'm busy. I'm doing church. I'm doing visitation. I'm here tonight. I'm doing lots of things. I'm busy. You've heard it said, so busy in the work of the Lord that we have forgotten the Lord of the work. Someone has said that busyness produces barrenness. Sometimes the opposite is true. Sometimes barrenness produces busyness. Sometimes people that are empty and barren and dry and thirsty get busy to compensate for that. That there are people that the sole existence of their reason for coming to church is just to be an usher. It's great to be an usher. Every church has what we call the thermostaters. They're the guys who just kind of roam the halls and, you know, see if the parking lot's still there. I'm sure what they do. But, you know, they don't really come to church. They just come to do a function. I was in a church in Ohio where the pastor said, Steve, I got a guy like that in my church. He's the chairman of the Sunday school. He said, I've been here 11 years. He's never heard me preach one time on Sunday morning. Because every Sunday morning after Sunday school, he goes back into his office, and for the whole worship service, he sits there and he writes little numbers in his book. He said, it wouldn't be too bad to plug in his coffee pot. He said, I'm preaching away. I can hear this boop, 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 you know, and this aroma drifting in the back of the auditorium. And nothing wrong with coffee. Nothing wrong with writing numbers in a book, I guess. But if that's the sole experience of your Christianity, then that's not my question. I want to know really, not what you're doing, how are you? See, how am I? Well, I think I'm okay. In fact, I'll tell you what I think. We love to give people peace of our mind, don't we? Some of us don't have too much to spare. We need to kind of ration it out just a little bit. Here's the only level I think you're going to meet God on. I'm going to call it the I am level. And it's just the level of transparent honesty. And we talked about getting vulnerable this morning. But until you get honest about what you're really seeking to fill the void of your life, until you empty your life of the wrong things, you're not going to fill it with the right things. I think basically, as a Christian, there's only two basic questions that you and I are going to have to answer on this side of eternity. And the starting point for us is to acknowledge that we really have some issues. You might say, if I ask you how you are, you would say, well, I'm hurting. That's how I am. Maybe that would describe you. You say, well, the honest truth about my life is I'm fearful. I'm fearful about our culture. I'm fearful for my kids, my grandkids. Or you might say, I'm angry. Some of us just live in a state of anger. Is that you? Just angry at somebody or something. Or maybe you feel like this guy sometimes. Ever feel like this with your computer? I have. Man, where'd that go? How come I can't get this downloaded? What's the deal here, right? Angry. Or maybe your issue is bitterness. Just because someone hurt you, they wronged you, they said something. Or maybe you might say, I'm immoral. These are honest answers. These are transparent answers. And until we come to this level of transparency and honesty about what really we're filling our life with and empty ourselves of those things, we're not going to fill it with the right things. So two basic questions this side of eternity that every person has to answer. Bottom line, two questions. Number one is, what is your relationship with Jesus Christ? That's the bottom line question of life for you. Okay, that determines whether you're a Christian. Outside of that question, outside of your salvation, as a Christian, if I could funnel all of Christianity down into one question, I'd say, here's the bottom line question for Christianity, for every single person here. Who gets control of your life? That's the bottom line question. Who is in charge? Who is in control of you? Now, I'm going to do a little skit here. Jimmy is our team pastor, and I'm going to share this little skit with you. The reason I like this skit is because I get to play the part of Jesus, so I like that. So here we go.
Jesus, I want you to have this.
Really?
Yes.
You know whoever sits here makes all the decisions.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, I make decisions all the time, but you make the best ones. So I want you to sit right here and start making them.
You're sure?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
This is a good idea.
All right, yeah.
Yeah.
This feels good. That's great.
Okay. Oh, hang on a second. I got a phone call.
Okay, sure.
All right. Hey, Chuck, what's up? Are you going to go buy a shotgun? That's cool.
All right. Oh, wait, I thought you and your wife were trying to get out of debt.
Mm, that's good.
Oh, you're not going to tell her.
Ooh, that's bad.
Oh, okay. Oh, you want me to come with you?
No.
No. I mean, I don't know. Let me call you back and get back with you on that.
Jimmy?
Yeah?
What's the deal here?
What?
I'm kind of one-cheeking it here.
I'm sorry.
I thought you wanted me to sit here.
I do. I just kind of, I lost my head. Yeah.
This is the decision-making place.
Yes, I know. And I want you to sit
here. You're sure?
I absolutely, yes.
Okay, I'll try again.
Okay, right. Yeah.
Okay, let me start this time.
Okay, all right.
You know, I've been noticing some things about you, and your attitude
see,
has
I know what you're going to say, Jesus.
You do?
Yeah, I do. See, you just don't understand the whole situation.
Yeah, but your attitude is a choice.
Yeah, I've got a lot going on, Jesus.
But you're the pressure. Jimmy, what is the deal
Jesus,
here?
Jesus, you don't understand pressure.
I thought you wanted me to sit on that chair. I thought you wanted me to be in control.
I do.
Well, then you've got to give me the chair.
Okay, take it.
You've got to make a decision. You've got to make a choice.
I didn't know it'd be this hard.
Well, you've got to make a choice.
I can't.
You just did. Now, you see, in the throne room of your heart, there's one chair. Only one person sits here. And what we say is, I want God to be in control of my life. I want him to be the king, the Lord of lords, the king of kings. But whenever something comes up that isn't quite to our liking or that is a little too hard for us, then we say, you know, Lord, you've kind of been away for a while. Why don't you get in the back seat? Let me take the throne. Let me drive. Now we wouldn't say that bluntly to him like that, but by the way that we live, that's what we do. And as a result of that, our life evidences the fact that he is not sitting on the throne. And the real evidence of who gets control shows when you get squeezed. That is the real truth. The real you is not sitting here in church. You're sitting here trying to pay attention, trying to be, you know, a nice person. But the real issue is when you get squeezed. Let's just say I've been working on my grip, which I haven't. Let's say I was working on my grip, and I could take this orange, and I could squeeze the life out of this orange until it would explode, what would come out? Orange juice. We had Cecilia draw a picture of that over here. And that's great. What if before the service, I took a hypodermic needle, stuck it in there, pulled out all the juice in the pulp, filled it back up with black Indian ink, and then squeezed it, what would come out? Black ink. And why is that? Because whatever's on the inside of something comes out when it gets squeezed. Proverbs puts it this way: our attitude is the light God uses to expose our true heart. Our attitude, the spirit of a man, is like the candle of the Lord searching the innermost parts of the belly, one version says. And God uses our attitude to show what our idols are, who is really in control, and really the idol we're bowing down to is us. And so when we get squeezed, what happens, that circumstances, whatever's on the inside, that circumstance squeezes out the real us. You're minding your own business, and when you get sitting out with your kids at the table, and you're minding your own business, and your child spills the milk. Now listen, we had six kids. There were times I wanted to come to the table, take the milk, dump it out. It's going to get there anyway. Let's get it over with. You ever felt like that? I mean, they should invent a table where the top 2 inches are a sponge. It'd be a great invention, right? But, you know, they spill the milk, and you say, look what you did. You spilled your milk again. Where'd you get your brain from? Your mother? You stomp and storm and rant and rave, you know, and after a while you cool off, and she says, honey, why'd you get so mad? I'm not mad. Okay. And finally you cool down. She says, honey, why'd you act like that? And you say this: if that kid wouldn't have spilled their milk, I wouldn't have got so mad. So what are you saying? You're saying that circumstances made you an angry person. But the fact is, circumstances don't make you what you are. Circumstances reveal what you are. And the circumstances of our life reveal who is really in charge, who's really on the throne and in charge of our life. So as we walk through these next moments, I want you to identify who really sits on the throne. Who is really in charge, who is really in control of your life. And to be honest about that. The fact is, we don't do a great job at doing that. Take your Bible and turn to John, if you would, John chapter 10. Idolatry, or John chapter 4, idolatry is anything that we value more than God. Anything you value more than God is idolatry. And the things you value more than God are the things sitting on the throne of your life. And we want to identify some of those here in these next few moments. John 10 is the account of Jesus as he meets the woman at the well. It's a familiar story, but I want to walk through it with you and look and see, hear what Jesus did as he addressed this woman. So John 10, and you know the story, perhaps John 4, that Jesus comes to this well. He's been traveling and he's thirsty. And this isn't just some, you know, ordinary well. Look at verse 3. This is John 4:3. He left Judah and went to, again, the Galilee, and as he had to pass through Samaria, and there he came to a city of Samaria called Sychar, near a parcel of ground that Jacob gave his son Joseph. This is Jacob's well. You can go back in the Old Testament and see the history. This is an important site. And so he comes to this very storied well, and verse 6, so Jesus, being wearied from his journey, was sitting thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour. Why did Jesus go to the well? What's the answer? Why did he go to the well? He wanted water. He was thirsty. That's right. And why did this woman come to the well? She was thirsty. Okay, Jesus had some physical needs. And we all have those needs, and there's nothing wrong with that. And he wants us to get our needs met. There's nothing wrong with getting physical needs met. It's when those physical needs become idolatrous and all-consuming that there's a problem. There's nothing wrong with wanting to get food, with wanting to get water, with wanting to have our physical needs met. But we have let some of those things that we need become controlling in us. God's word has a lot to say regarding idols, and those verses are listed there in your book. We know that the commandments, two of the Ten Commandments, deal with idolatry. Apparently, it was a pretty important issue, or God wouldn't have spent so much time talking about it. Now, when we think of coming to a well, we don't have to do what these ladies are doing. We get so, you know, used to just being able to turn that tap on and it coming out. And we're spoiled. And you understand that you've gone through times where the power's been out or whatever, and you haven't had water. And it's quite an ordeal. And this lady who's going to this well, this is something they have to do daily, because they have to come out and they walk back from the city. And some people walk miles every day just to do what we can do, and go turn on a tap. And so it was a very legitimate need. Nothing wrong with wanting water. But the problem is, we have got water put on the throne. There are things like water in different areas that we have made so important that we've missed what's really most important. So let's look at this passage. Here this lady comes, and the first thing that we see here in verse 6 is our thirst is revealed by our weariness. Okay? Jesus was weary. He's tired. He was weary from his journey. And he comes to this well because he needed something to drink. The 6 hours, the middle of the day. And there came a woman from Samaria to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me to drink." Now the significance of that is that in this culture, obviously, the Jews didn't talk to Samaritans. You talk about racism. This was like incredible racism. And there was this great gap between the Jews and Samaritans. And so for Jesus even to talk to her, she was kind of shocked. His disciples had gone away to buy food at the city. And this woman, verse 9, says to him, how is it that you, being a Jew, ask me for a drink since I'm a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. And Jesus answered and said to her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that says to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. That's the solution right there, that living water. Now why don't we realize that we need that water? I think either you are ignoring your thirst, and a lot of people are doing that, or we've come to the point where we deny our thirst, or we embrace our thirst. And in these days, I hope that you'll come to a point where you will embrace the fact that you have a thirst for this living water and let go of the substitutes you've been trying to fill your life with. My wife read me an article recently that said, I like coffee. She said that coffee makes you more thirsty. It doesn't hydrate you. It dehydrates you. I said, how can that be? It's all water. I just put water and a little bit of black stuff in there, and it's all water. And I suppose it's probably true. That there are things that we do, even that look good, but they don't end up helping us with what we're really trying to do and put right, good, healthy water into us. Living water, obviously. He's talking about him. But even in a physical sense. And so sometimes we ignore the fact that we need water. Sometimes we deny the fact that we need him. And then some of us, I believe, will come to the place where we embrace that. Have you denied the fact that you really need God more than you do right now? Here's the deal. We are all broken. We all have issues. Turn to the person next to you and say to them, I have issues. Not Steve. Say your name. Tell them you have issues. And I have issues too. But tell them that you have issues. But we don't like to acknowledge that. Listen, this is a place for broken people. We all have issues. And you're not going to get your needs met. You're not going to get your cup filled until you empty yourself of the pride that says, I've got it all together. Or I got this all figured out. Thirst is really your appetite for God. That's what it should be. And the problem is, we have come to the place where we have put so many false things, coffee with sweet and low in it, or whatever. And as a result of that, we have not got our needs met. So he says, I need living water. So she says in verse 11, sir, I have nothing, you have nothing to draw the water, and the well is deep. This goes right over her head, you know, that he's talking about himself. Where are you going to get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank it himself and his sons and his cattle? And Jesus said to her, everyone who drinks this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks the water I will give him shall never thirst. But the water I will give him will become like a well of water springing up to eternal life. Now, if I was Jesus at this point, I would have jumped through all these other passages and I would have gone right to verse 25, or verse 26, where Jesus said, I am the Messiah. I skipped over all this other stuff. That's the way I would have done it. Bottom line. But Jesus knew that until she was emptied of her substitutes, she was never going to be filled with living water. So the second thing we see is that he had to communicate to her this truth that C.S. Lewis said so well. He said, if I find in myself a desire which no experience on this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is I was made for another world. He had to show her that all the things she was going to for satisfaction were not doing it for her. And we've got to come to the place. Lewis said, if I try to get my needs met and nothing on this earth meets those needs, then I've got a conclusion. I'm not meant for this world. And we aren't either. We've got to live with a different focus. This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. I love that little saying. And Lewis said it well. And the same thing then is true for us. So our thirst is revealed by our weariness, secondly, our thirst remains after artificial substitutes. So he was going to show this woman now in the next few verses, you've been trying to fill your life and it's not cutting it for you. And I've got some news for you. But first of all, before I tell you the solution and explain that to you, I'm going to expose what your needs are. So he goes, and the woman says in verse 15, said to him, give me this water, and I'll not be thirsty, and I won't hunger to drink water. And so he's going to start identifying now what her needs are. Verse 16, he says to her, go call your husband to come here. The first artificial substitute he identifies in this lady is relationships. Reggie mentioned it this morning as he talked about this woman's need. I heard about a couple. They were going to get married, and they wanted to have something real romantic on their wedding cake. And so they were going to put 1 John 4:18, which says there's no perfect love cast. There's no fear in love. Perfect love casts out all fear. But somehow in the translation, the first got knocked off, and all they got was John 4:18. So their wedding cake said this: "You've had five husbands. The one you have now is not your husband." Not good for wedding cake. Okay, so you want to make sure when you do those first and second things, you have the right numeral there. But anyway, so Jesus says to her in verse 16, go call your husband. And the woman answered and said, I don't have a husband. He said, yeah, you've said that right. You don't have a husband. You've had five husbands, and you're living with a guy now who's not even your husband. And he said, the point is you have tried to make relationships your God. That is the idol of your life. That person, and as we walk through this, there are some things you're going to have to identify and say, I have been more concerned about what that person thinks than what God thinks. I have pursued that person more than I've pursued God. And some of us have made an idol out of a child, an idol out of a spouse. We're more concerned about their opinion and what they think than what God thinks. We spend more time worrying about them than about God. Not that you should worry at all. I'm just saying our focus is in the wrong place. And for her, she had thought, if I can have these relationships, then that's going to be the thing that's going to meet my need. That was her idol. And so he says, the woman said to him, Lord, sir, I love verse 19. I perceive you're a prophet. Wow, there's a news flash, you know. He's just predicted, told her this. Just, wow, you must be a prophet. Smart. And so what does she do? Does she bow to him right there as a prophet? No. You know what she does? She changes the subject. You know what some of us do when God starts getting close to some of the idols of our life? We try to say, yeah, but look at all I've done. Look at all the mission trips I've gone on. Look at the position I hold, the money I've given. So what she does is she starts changing the subject. She starts talking about religion. That's a good thing to talk about, right? Let's just talk about that for a little bit. She said, our fathers worshiped in this mountain, and you people say that Jerusalem is a place men ought to worship. So now, rather than dealing with the issues of her bad relationships, she tries to switch gears and says, let's talk about religion for a minute. Because I perceive you're a prophet, right? And Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem you'll worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know. For salvation is from the Jews. The point is, she's wanting to talk about the where of worship. Now, you know, here it's amazing. Even back in this culture, they're arguing about music. Now, I'm sure you've never had that issues here. Your church doesn't face that battle because no one would be concerned about that, because the real issue about worship is about Christ. It's not about, is it your preference or do I like this? It's about, is God being honored? Is God being worshiped? And I'm sure you've never had that issue here because you're not like most churches. But anyway, so she starts talking about this, and Jesus said it's not about the where of worship. And he begins to talk about verse 23. He talks about the when of worship. The hour is coming when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For such people, the Father seeks to be his worshipers. It talks about there's a time coming. There's the when of worship. Then he talks about the how of worship in verse 24. God is spirit. Those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. So it's about a person. So he addresses her issues of religion because that's where she's going. Remember, he's dismantling all the things that she has used as artificial substitutes before he gives her the living water. The fact is, you will find something to worship. Everyone worships something. It may be your security. It may be your bank account. It may be your job. It may be your sports team. Our heart is a worship factory. And everyone finds something that they're going to worship. So Jesus wants to identify the wrong thing. You're going to find something to worship. So he's addressed worship now. And so he tells her about this. Now verse 25, the woman said to him, this is incredible to me. Here this Jesus is announcing, he's told her about her life. He's explained to her about her religion. And she shifts gears again, and she says, I know that the Messiah is coming. Isn't that crazy? She's talking to the Messiah, and she's informing the Messiah about himself. That just fascinates me. So now her reputation, her wisdom, have you ever met somebody who just knows it all? Every time you talk to them, oh, yeah, I know that. Oh, yeah, I know. Doesn't that drive you crazy? I mean, we were, as a family some years ago, we were realizing that we kept, as we talked to each other, we'd always say, yeah, I know. And so we said, let's not do it anymore. Let's just say, if we already know something and someone's talking, let's just say, you're right. Yeah, you're right. That focuses on them. But there are some people, you just can't tell them anything. You know people like that? People that make, you know, a cup of coffee nervous, you know those kind of people? I mean, give aspirin a headache. I mean, just every time you talk to them, it's just like that you can never tell them a thing. So here is this lady telling the Messiah about the Messiah. Isn't that crazy? Now, I know, she says, the Messiah is coming. He who's called Christ. When that one comes, he will declare all things to us. And it's just, he is exposing this woman, her lifestyle of sin, her idol of relationships, her issue of religion, that hers is better because they worship at the right place. And now, as she tries to prove her prideful reputation of knowing things about the Messiah as she talks to him, and until those things are dismantled, she's not going to be changed. And the problem with us so many times is we have so much pride that fuels our hearts, and we worship who we are and what we know. Her pride became the object of her worship. She was proud of her theological stance. It's so easy in our culture, because there is such a dearth of good theology in our culture. It's very easy to get caught up in theological pride because we know what is right. And that may be true. But the way that's communicated and the how that's communicated is an idol sometimes in our life. And so Jesus now has blown apart all these idols of her. He's dismantled her relationships, her religion. And then he says this. Jesus, I know the Messiah is going to come. And then verse 26, I am the one who you're speaking about. I am he. I am the Messiah. And all of a sudden, all those idols that she had erected, and she sees this is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And now there's a ground that water can be poured onto and absorbed. Before, it was just stony and rocky and hard. Because of the idolatrous stony heart. Jesus said, I am he. I am the Messiah. I am the person that you're speaking about. Now, I want you to think about, I want you to take out that little cup now, and I want you to think about in your life, what are some artificial substitutes, some idols that you would have to, if you were honest, would have to say, these are some things. It may be some of those things you wrote down at the top of things you enjoy. That you've made an idol of. You've got to acknowledge those first. So what are the things that have been the priority over God in your life? Just, if you would be honest. It could be just that you want the attention of people or the acceptance of people. These could be that just I want someone's approval. And you've been more concerned about man's approval. Could be your education. That's become your point of pride. And you've got to make sure everyone knows about that. It could be your achievements and what you've done. And your idol has been to have one more achievement, one more thing, one more little thing you can one more notch on your gun. Could be your friends. And you've worshipped your friends and been more concerned about what they thought about you and made sure they saw all the wonderful part of your life on Facebook or whatever. And your friends have become an idol. Could be a person you're dating. Could be sports. I think many men would have to put sports down as an idol. Because you can spend hours, some of you know more of the names of your favorite team's football players than you know the 12 disciples. I mean, you can name everything about your team, and it's become an idol in your life. And until you've emptied your life, I'm not saying you can't ever watch sports, but you've got to identify, I spend much more time thinking and focusing on that team than I do on God. So it's become a substitute. Could be music. Nothing wrong with music. But even Christian music, you can put music. Some of us spend hours and hours and pay big bucks to go to concerts and spend all this time about the music scene, but very little time in the Word of God, in prayer, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. We want to be entertained. We don't mind someone singing to us, but it's become an idol in our life. It could be just the whole issue of competition and your career. It could be just being famous in some arena or something. It could be your computer can become your God. How many hours do you spend on your computer, your tablet, your phone, just surfing, just looking, just doing Facebook or Pinterest or emails or whatever it is? Not because it's work-oriented, but because it's just there compared to times you spend in things that are eternal. And for some, that's become a god in your life. You may have to put your phone down as an idol in your life. I'd say there's some people, I made a commitment in the morning, I'm not going to get up and look at my emails, my text messages, or the news, or the weather, or anything technologically until, first of all, I've talked with God. Who's the first person you talk to? We spend all, I was in a church one time, and I was talking to the staff just about priorities, and I was challenging them just to give the first moments of their day with God. And one of the staff guys was was kind of bivocational. He said, Steve, I'm just too busy. I just can't give. I said, well, tell me about how you start your day. So I get up in the morning, I spend the first 15 minutes reading the newspaper, drinking a cup of coffee, and I said, wait. The first 15 minutes you spend reading the paper, just stop that and read the Bible instead. I said, oh, yeah, I could do that. It's amazing how simple it can be. But what if you made a commitment not to look at any technology until, first of all, you look to God? It's become an idol in life. How much time do you spend preparing yourself for the day compared to preparing yourself to meet God spiritually for the day? What if you gave at least the same amount of time to spiritual things in the morning that you gave to physical things? How much time does it take you to shave and shower and feed your face and get dressed? We give much more time to our physical appearance than our spiritual appearance. So maybe you need to put down just your priorities and your physical appearance. Could be your career. That could be your God. And your decisions are based on, where is this going to take me? Am I going to get the most money here? If I make this advance, then rather than saying, I better make sure the place I'm going has a body of believers I can lock into and be encouraged by. We didn't think about that. We get to a town, then we look for a church. Look for the church first. What is your priority? Do you care about things of eternity or just things here? It could be food. You may have to put food down as an idol because you run to that many times. You may have to put down a sport, hunting. And again, nothing wrong with hunting. Nothing wrong with having a car. But for some, you know, we're saving all this money so we can have this certain car because that's going to make everything wonderful for us. Some of us made a little god out of our car. It's a little idol out in the parking lot. If you want to see if it's somebody's idol, go put a dent in it and see how they respond to it. I don't do that on purpose. But I'm just saying, sometimes that can be an idol in our life. It could be your clothes. I was with a pastor some years ago, back up to the car, and he had a little red Porsche. You have one of those, don't you, Pastor? A little red Porsche. And he stood and he said, you know, that thing has been such a god in my life. It didn't cost him a whole lot. I mean, he you know, rebuilt it anyway. But he said, no one drives that car. No one touches that car. It's my car. And God said, That's not your car. That's God said, it's his car. I realized I had to give it back to God. It was an idol. It's not bad to have a nice car. I'm not saying that. It's not bad to have good clothes or go on a nice vacation. But some of us, if I could just have that vacation, then everything would be wonderful. And we're worshiping even the idea of a vacation in that perfect place. It could be some pleasure that you adjust yourself to, some property. It can be a thing like pornography. That can be an idol that you run to get your needs met because you feel like you deserve that and your husband or wife's not meeting those needs. Could be drugs, prescription drugs. So you just want to kind of, if I can just, you know, float off and I have to worry about something so I can just, you know, drug myself or alcohol myself up or whatever it is so I can not have to feel the pain that I'm in. And that can be a god in your life, an idol. Could be power. One of the reasons that some of us don't drop our guard and acknowledge our needs is because we want to look like we've got it all together. We don't even know that we have needs because we might lose some power in the church or some influence in that meeting that we want to have some say in. Gambling and the stock market. Nothing wrong with the stock market. Nothing wrong with golf. These are not bad things, all of them. They're just things that become so important. I was in a meeting where a guy said, golf is such an idol in my life. I'll be sitting in the service while the pastor's preaching, thinking about fixing my golf swing. He said, it's an idol. He went to his wife that week, and he said, honey, golf's been an idol in my life. I'm going to put my golf clubs in the closet, and I'm not going to take them out until you tell me I can, and I'm not going to ask you. A year and a half went by, and finally, after a year and a half, she said, you know, I think you could probably play a game of golf again without it being an idol. He left them in there for another year just to make sure. He loved golf. But for 2.5 years, he said, I'm not going to do that. I was with a pastor in Illinois. He said, Steve, I just spend hours watching baseball. What's the ESPN? I couldn't think of it. ESPN. He said, I'm not watching bad things. I know some of you are big into the Cubs and big into this week, and I know this is going to be some real decisions about the World Series and all this sort of stuff. And he said, I'll sit there and watch a doubleheader on TV. Now, I don't like baseball very well. It's too slow for me. I played baseball in college, but watching, it's just too slow. And so I played doubleheaders. I know how long it takes to play one. Probably takes about the same time to watch one, I would assume, right? And so he said, it's not that I'm watching bad things. It's just the hours and hours. And so you know what he did? He unplugged his cable. He said, I'm going to unplug it for a year. And in a year, I'll plug it back in and see if it's under control. He said the cable had become an idol in his life. I'm not saying it's sin to have cable. Is it an idol in your life? And maybe you just need to draw some guides about that. And it can even be church. Church can be an artificial substitute. We can come and do our little act of service, and that has become more important than God himself. So why don't you write down on that cup, what are the idols that you would have to identify? What are the things that would be, it could be not marriage or your children. There's just a thousand things. Exercise. I've met people that are just, they can't stand still because they're just locked into this exercise thing. Jogging. Who? I don't understand jogging. I can't handle running. I can run if I have a basketball or something, but just to run, I mean, who does that? I mean, people do, I know. But maybe it's fine, but if you're locked into that and you can't get along without that, and if you don't get your calisthenics, you don't get to the gym or whatever, sports center, some ladies say, yeah, put that one down in my husband's cup. He's got to watch his sports center or whatever. Again, not bad things. Just things. That certain show rules your life. I got to see that show. Starbucks. I like Starbucks. Nothing wrong with Starbucks. But some people, they can't get by without their coffee, without their whatever it might happen to be. Again, not shopping. Could be, man, when I'm down, I just go shopping. I don't, but that may be you, right? Just be whatever it is that controls you. Walmart. Not a bad thing. When I die, I'm going to be buried at Walmart. So my wife will come visit me. But no, because we're there a lot. And nothing wrong with Walmart. Okay, it's not. But all I'm saying is all these things are artificial substitutes, idols that we've put in place of God. I want you to see one last verse. Our thirst is revealed by our weariness. It remains after artificial substitutes. Look back at verse number 12. Here's the bottom line. Our thirst is only relieved by the superior greatness of God. Here's the question. She asked this question. And here's the question for you tonight. Verse 12. Are you greater than our father Jacob? Yes! The answer has to be that Jesus is superior to Jacob. He's superior to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's superior to every idol that you've written down on that cup, everything that you have substituted to try to run to get your needs met. And until you can come to a place where you can say, God is the superior greatness to all these other things, and I'm going to empty my life of all these idols so I can be filled with him. But until you empty your cup of the idols, you've not acknowledged the superior greatness of God. So tonight, my challenge to you is to say, I want to answer the question that this lady at the well asked. Is Jesus in your heart superior to every other thing, every other person, every other idol in your life? And when you can acknowledge that he is the superior greatness, all these substitutes I'm going to let go of, then that's when God can begin to fill your life and fill it with himself here in these next days. Let's bow our heads and close our eyes. I want you to take a moment here in these last moments on that cup to finish writing down anything that God's brought to your heart that's an idol. Anything in your heart that you would have to say has had greater priority, is of greater importance, I've spent greater time with, greater thought of, anything in your life that has become an idol. I want you to write it down on that cup. I've asked Darren to close tonight by singing a song. And as he sings this, I want you to think about the words of this song too. Anything in my life that is more important than God is an idol. And I want you to write it down in that cup. And as God prompts your heart, when he gets through or whenever, I want to ask you to come down to this platform, this altar, and kneel down here and take your cup and just talk to God and say, God, here are the idols in my life. I've written them down here on this cup. And then just dump it out on the altar. Turn that cup upside down and say, God, I'm emptying myself of these idols. I'm answering the question that you are the superior greatness to all these things in my life. And I'm letting go of these idols. I'm acknowledging your superior greatness. I want you to fill me now in these next days with your truth, with your life. But you can't be filled till you're emptied. So take a moment, listen to this song. As God prompts your heart, write those things down in that cup. And as God prompts your heart, you come down, dump them out here at this altar. Talk to God for a few moments. When you're finished, you're dismissed. When God's done with you, you can leave. But don't leave until you've really dealt with the idolatry, anything in your life. that you love more than God, write it down, come dump it out.